If you are courting anybody, I wonder who it might be. If you're dating someone, who is it? In this book, which is full of proverbs, there are two ladies particularly that are mentioned, one of which we may court. I don't think both at the same time. One is Madam Folly, and the other is Lady Wisdom. And it is about this lady that this chapter in particular does have something to say, and which will just engage our attention for this evening. Subject is wisdom's heights, the heights of wisdom. My reason for so choosing that as a title is what is suggested in the second verse of chapter 8, where it says with regards to this woman, that is wisdom, that she takes her stand on the top of the high hill. That's where she is to be found. That is her location. Why is she there? Why is she standing there? Why is she on the top of the high hill? It's there at that particular point that she mounts her rostrum. That is the speaker's platform. And it is from there that she addresses the flow of humanity, which seemingly stand at the crossroads of life, because the text goes on to say, after telling us that she takes her stand on the top of the high hill, that it's beside the way. It's where the paths meet. And it's at the crossroads. Now, what we find here in chapter 8, and we'll find it elsewhere, is that wisdom happens to be personified. So reference is made to the personification of wisdom. She seemingly takes on the attributes of one whom we can identify as being like unto us, and with particular reference to a lady. She is likened to a woman because mention is made in verse 1 to her voice. We are told in verse 2 that she takes her stand. In verse 3, and I want you to notice the pronouns, of course, that she cries out by the gates at the entrance of the city. Much earlier on, in chapter 1 itself, we were introduced to her when in verse 21, we read there, wisdom calls aloud outside. She raises her voice in the open squares. She cries out in the chief concourses at the opening of the gates to the city, and she speaks her words. Chapter 9, the first three verses may be of interest because we're told that wisdom has built her house. She has hewn out her seven pillars. She has slaughtered her meat. She has mixed her wine. She has also furnished her table. She has sent out her maidens. She cries out from the highest places in the city. And in chapter 14 and verse 1, the wise woman builds her house, but the foolish pulls it down with her hands. And for what is a very fine description of this woman, well, you have it in Proverbs chapter 31, a passage of scripture that will be well known to you, and we have the question posed in the 10th verse, who can find a virtuous wife? Her worth is far above rubies. And here is wisdom itself in relation to a husband, to children, to servants, to those outside the domestic sphere, as she engages in business, in commerce, etc. And she applies wisdom to all these areas of her relationships and also her responsibilities. So wisdom is personified. She takes on, as it were, the role of a woman who conducts herself in such an able manner and is simply one who is worthy to be known, one who is worthy to court and to be married to. Now you notice that this woman, Wisdom, she addresses certain people. So we look at the persons that she addresses, and we are told that they are men. She speaks to them, crying out by the gates, and says in verse 4, O men, to you, O men, I call. Now, it may be that there is in mind specifically the men. Nowadays, we have to be very careful, it seems, that we do not discriminate too much between the men and the women, and everyone's kind of got to have some sort of equal position and place and say and so on, and we must not leave anybody with the feeling or the impression that the woman is inferior. Well, that's not really what one is driving at. Really, what one is simply saying is that men have a responsibility. They have a task. It's a calling of theirs to assume the role of a decision maker and to be a leader within their own home and then in other areas of life also. And if anybody needs to hear what is said in the book of Proverbs, it happens to be men. Men that are husbands, men that are fathers, men who are in waiting to be husbands or to be fathers, and that they should begin to learn now the lessons and to understand something of the role and responsibility that is going to be laid upon them. I think the world in general has very few leaders, and certainly that would be true of the church itself. And we need, therefore, reformation, and we need a recovery of what has been lost, because we have become somewhat effeminate in many respects, and we have tended to sit back, and men themselves need once again to recognize the God-given calling to be leaders within their own household, leaders within the church, and leaders in some other area where maybe they have been appointed to fulfill that particular function and role. And so however long it takes, let us learn from the examples that pass by us, those who we can read about in times before we ourselves existed, and let us glean these lessons. Men themselves must be morally active in assuming the role of leadership within their own homes. And so wisdom addresses men in particular, but that's not to say that the ladies are not addressed. They too are to apply their hearts to wisdom. And hence, if you go to Proverbs 31, verse 10, here's an outstanding woman. Here's an excellent wife. Here's an excellent mother. Here's an excellent neighbor. An excellent businesswoman, in fact, who is applying certainly wisdom in day-to-day living. So the word is to men, all people. And then you notice in particular, it is addressed to the naive, to the simple. Wisdom calls out to the simple ones and invites them to understand prudence. And those that are naive and simple are those that lack wisdom. They lack discernment, they lack judgment, and they may well be considered as fools. As you go on to read in verse 5, O you simple or naive ones, understand prudence, and you fools, be of an understanding heart. There's a great deal of levity in the world at the present time. Things are trivialized in so many respects. And you look for a tone of seriousness in discussion and debate. If you give any attention to the media at all, just in a very superficial way, the people that are occupying, as it were, panels for discussion or are invited to take their place upon a platform, it's almost hilarity, it's comedy, it's fun time, its shallowness, etc. Where do we get serious debate? Where do we get a sort of a solemn approach to the issues of life which are going to be discussed at a deep level itself? And here then we are to see fools not as those who are in the local madhouse or anything of that kind, not those who have straws coming out of their ears as though they're country bumpkins, as we might say in England, etc., but here are fools in all areas of life who do not apply wisdom. They have knowledge, they have information at their fingertips, almost literally, and certainly we're not without information today, but what we do lack is wisdom, and so there is an absence of that. These are also referred to in Proverbs chapter 1 as scorners in the 22nd verse. How long will you simple ones, you naive ones, will you love simplicity? For scorners delight in their scorning, and fools hate knowledge. They shrug their shoulder, they dismiss things with a laugh, and they go on their merry way, engaged in acts of stupidity and showing a degree of immaturity that is unbecoming for those who really should be showing the signs and the marks of leadership, and that ought to be so in the church. But I want you to note that as you read this passage, that there is a genuine plea as well as pity for those who scorn and spurn what would enrich them. So there is this invitation. You get it in chapter 1, you shouldn't get it here in chapter 8, at the gates, to the entrance of the city. At the gates is where the judges, the magistrates would sit, and they would deal with the concerns and the cares of a people who would come to them for counsel and for advice. And here is wisdom, and she places herself in a location where she can be easily seen, where she can be easily heard. She's not hiding her tracks in any way. In chapter 7, there was another woman, and she was the woman of the streets, and she lurks at street corners. You will find her in the shadows, and she is somewhat alluring, but she is one who conceals her intentions, and they're not of the best. And so therefore she wants to be hidden, she doesn't want to be seen, and these things are done privately and secretly. But wisdom is in the open. You can see my face. You know where I am, and you can hear my voice. And so here is wisdom, therefore, very open, and not only open with respect to her heart, not only open with regards to her mouth, but with an embrace, if you like, inviting these naive, simple ones to come and to find wisdom. And she pleads with them, and she takes pity upon them, because if they go in the way that they have chosen to go, then they will fall headlong into destruction, and they will lose everything that they have, and they don't have very much even now. Now, going beyond the personification of wisdom, going beyond the persons whom she addresses, there are certain priorities that she states and which she highlights and underlines, and she makes reference to prudence and to understanding. You'll notice in verse 5 that it's almost as if she has a twin sister. Oh, you simple ones, understand prudence. Verse 12, I, wisdom, dwell with prudence and find out knowledge and destruction and discretion. And so there are certain priorities that wisdom has. Now, when reference is made to prudence and to understanding, she is actually talking about things that are excellent and of considerable worth. If we could translate the term that is being used, it's a reference to that which is noble and that which is princely. And so we are looking at what has considerable quality. In the 6th verse, listen, for I will speak of excellent things, and from the opening of my lips will come right things. These are things that are excellent, and we are to meditate upon them, and we are to dwell upon them. Verse 7 is truth. My mouth will speak truth, and wickedness is an abomination to my lips. In verse 10, reference is made to instruction. Receive my instruction, so she says. And there again in verse 11, wisdom. For wisdom is better than. And so she has these priorities, and a value is placed on these intangibles. You can't actually hold them and weigh them and measure them as you can gold or silver, etc. What is their value on the stock exchange at the present time? You can go and buy your bar of gold, as it were, and hide it away in the safe back home, etc. No, we're talking about the intangibles, and these are of more value than what people prize today. And so she says in verse 10, receive my instruction and not silver, and knowledge rather than choice gold. For wisdom is better than rubies, and all the things one may desire cannot be compared with her. So if you were to say something about your parents, what is it that they have left you that you prize more than anything else? Would you be able to look back and say, well, I thank God that I have parents who really left me the treasure and the heritage of wisdom and of understanding? If that was all that your dad or your mom left you, would you be thankful for that? Or would you be disappointed that it wasn't silver and gold and treasures untold, and that you failed to get your hands on that? Do you prize these things more than these tangibles? So here are these persons whom she addresses, and these are the priorities that she teaches. And even as Christians, we need to value these things, just as the wise man did long ago. And I wonder whether we value the wise man, the sophisticated philosopher. There was a time when people used to refer to philosopher kings. Philosopher kings. Not just simply kings who were noted for their military might and their prowess, but for those that were thinkers, like Alfred the Great. I don't know whether you've heard much about Alfred the Great, but if you haven't, may I just suggest you Google Alfred the Great, or turn to some history book, as it were, with regards to Alfred the Great. One of the greatest English kings, going back 1,000 years or more now, over 1,000 years, I think. Is it about that? Yes, somewhere along that line. A great king, he was indeed. And he was a philosopher. And he gave us literature, as well as other enactments and decrees and so on, as he ran the country from his own particular throne. Do we value wise men, wise women, etc.? Or is our interest in sports idols, celebrities? I have a growing dislike for celebrities, and yet they are idolized in these days. It's almost as if they are spokesmen or spokeswomen for every cause, and as if they somehow are the fount of all wisdom, as they pontificate and make pronouncements from some particular platform with regard to some issue of the day in which we are living. We somehow look up to the wealthy or the warrior or even the wizards of technology, and we sort of idolize these people who are part of the galaxy of those who shine brightest for us. But what about the wise men? What about the thinkers? What about the philosophers, as it were, the Christian prophets, the Christian apostles, and those who followed, those who succeeded them down through the ages, whose names ought to be household terms for us, and whom we have grown up to be introduced to because they are part of our heritage? They're the wise ones who walked in the ways of God, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Whether we think of David himself, or whether we think of the likes of Elijah, or the prophets such as Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Habakkuk and Amos and so on, as well as Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and Paul and John the divine and so on. Do we know much about these? And do we know much about those who have followed on, the Polycarps of this world, Irenaeus and Tertullian and so forth? Do we know about them? We know very much about the Martin Luthers and the John Calvins and the John Gills of this world and the Jonathan Edwards. Do we know about them? Are we interested in these and those who have gone out from their home country to spread the gospel of sovereign grace and to make known the news of redemption in the Lord Jesus Christ? When Solomon prayed, you will remember that he did not pray for wealth, but he prayed for wisdom. He did not ask for power, but prudence to guide his counsel. C.S. Lewis said, "The next best thing to being wise is to live in a circle of those who are." The next best thing to being wise is to live in the company of those who are wise. So where would you find the wise? Well, I would like to think that we can say, well, it's here, that's why we gather. That we are wise people, that we aspire to be wise. We delight in drinking from the well of holy wisdom as we read this book, reflect upon this book, have this book expounded and open to us, and that we meditate upon it and we discuss it when we go home or among ourselves as we meet here after about 7:40, quarter to eight, and we're just simply there. You begin to talk about the message, the things that you have heard about. The mind almost instinctively goes to, what are you doing next week? Or, what did you do last week? And we're talking about the weather, and we're talking about other matters which are certainly important and not insignificant, but what about talking about the things of God and about that kingdom we mentioned this morning? Let's be within the circle of those that are wise. Buy good books. Invest your money, if you've got any money to invest, in good books, solid, sound, good books. If possible, make sure that they're hardcovers, so that they will last and that they will endure. Paper is fine, but if you can get a hardcover, all the better, and it's worth paying the extra dollars in order to get it. The books are very expensive these days. Share the books around. Invest in a good journal, a good theological journal, a good Christian journal, which makes you think. And you'll read it and say, well, I don't know what he's talking about. Fine. Read it again. Read it again. Read it again. And learn to be within that company of those who are seeking to delve deeply into the great things of God, that you will become learned men and women, and that you will be able to stand strong and steadfast in the years that come and lie ahead. And people will know you to be a wise person, which doesn't mean to say you yap. A person who yaps is not necessarily a wise person. It's just simply somebody who absorbs the teaching of God's word. And they know to speak when they should speak, and they know to be quiet when to be quiet. They have discernment and they have discretion. It's interesting to notice in this passage the promises that are made by wisdom. And if you look at them in verses 17 to 21, this is what she says. She says, I love those who love me, and those who seek me diligently will find me. Riches and honor are with me. Enduring riches and righteousness. My fruit is better than gold, yes, than fine gold, and my revenue than choice silver. I traverse the way of righteousness in the midst of the paths of justice, that I may cause those who love me to inherit wealth, that I may fill their treasuries. Those are promises. And what she's saying is, look, I can satisfy the deepest longings of your heart. Because there's nothing really in this world that will satisfy us ultimately. You can try all the wells, but they eventually dry up. But there is a well of salvation which will never dry up. And if you come to it, you will never thirst again. What? Never thirst again? No, never thirst again. That's what Jesus said to the woman who came to the well. And he pointed to another well where these waters are living waters that bubble up from within unto life everlasting. And so here is wisdom. She herself is offering that which will satisfy. We might find that as we go the way of wisdom, we will be successful, not with the poverty of wealth, but with the prosperity of wisdom. If all you aspire to is wealth, you'll be a poor man and you'll be a poor woman. So what if you have fine houses and you have nice cars and you have a lot of money? How poor you are, poor person. But wisdom, that's where the wealth is. And that's what we should be aspiring for. We should teach our sons and our daughters that that's what they really should be out for, the wisdom of this great God who bestows it so freely. Now, the other thing that's of interest here in the passage is the place from which she speaks. So we're really getting to the kind of topic, wisdom's heights. And you'll notice, therefore, in verse 2, she takes her stand on the top of the high hill. Unlike the streetwalkers I mentioned earlier on, she doesn't lurk at street corners, but she is conspicuously seen and heard. There are no whispers, and she raises her voice. She cries out. She lifts up her voice with words of truth, righteousness, and plainness. And she stands for all to see, and she inspires us to look at her. You can't miss her. Look at her. Listen to her. Live by her. And in verse 17, love her. Now that's an appeal to the affections. We are to love the Lord our God with all our heart and soul and mind and strength. The question is, do you love wisdom? If you don't, then you won't be seeking her. You won't be courting her. You won't be dating her. But if you love her, you can't do without her. She'll be on your mind day and night. She will be there accompanying you just like your shadow, because you love wisdom and you love her. And there's an intimacy in the sort of relationship that you have with her. But what interests us here for the moment is her location. Notice it says the high hill. Now, because of its importance, then the word that is used here is a reference to what is at the head. It's the highest. It's the pinnacle, and it is raised above the rise and fall of the surrounding landscape. So if you can imagine the undulating contours of the landscape itself, this hill rises above all the other hills within the landscape. And so it stands aloft, and it stands above and apart, where the air is pure and the scenery different to where Lady Folly dwells in the streets, at the corners, by busy plazas, and in the sight of the chambers of death. That's where Lady Folly is to be found, way back, as it were, in the alleyways of the city, where it's dark and dim. But here is wisdom on the heights, where the pure air is to be breathed in and to be found. Now, it's of interest because there are prominent locations for wisdom in the Bible. For example, did you know that in Eden there was to be found a mountain? In the Garden of Eden, there's a mountain. There is a high hill. If you look at Ezekiel 28, and it might be worth looking at, because Ezekiel is not necessarily one of the books that we turn to altogether very frequently, but if you turn to Ezekiel chapter 28 and verses 13 to 15, we read the following, verse 13. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was your covering, the sardius, topaz, and diamond, beryl, onyx, and jasper, sapphire, turquoise, and emerald with gold. The workmanship of your timbrels and pipes was prepared for you on the day you were created. You were the anointed cherub who covers. I established you. You were on the holy mountain of God. You walked back and forth in the midst of fiery stones. You were perfect in your ways from the day you were created till iniquity was found in you. And so here, one is looking back to Eden. And there is a description, if you like, of Eden itself as a garden. And within the garden is the holy mount of God. And if you look at chapter 42 of Ezekiel, you notice that Ezekiel links this mountain with the city. Ezekiel chapter 40 and verse 2. In the visions of God, he took me into the land of Israel and set me on a very high mountain. On it toward the south was something like the structure of a city. So what you have a mountain. It's a high place. And then also, there is brought into the picture a city. And the city is set upon a hill whose light cannot be hid. And the two images are often brought together. If you go back to Proverbs and the 8th chapter and verse 3, we have reference to the city. She cries out by the gates at the entry of the city, at the entrance of the doors. So she is on that high place, mountain heights, if you like, but there is, within that vicinity and location, a city that is to be found there. And it's something which the writer to the Hebrews makes mention of. If you turn to Hebrews now, chapter 12 and verse 22, the writer there brings together these two images, these two pictures, Hebrews 12 and verse 22. But you have come to Mount Zion, there's the mountain, and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to an innumerable company of angels. And interestingly, John also brings these two figures together. So you go right to the very end of the Bible, to the book of Revelation, and chapter 21 and verse 10. Revelation 21 verse 10, and yes, this is imagery before us. And John's saying that he, that is the Lord, carried away by the Spirit, in the Spirit, to a great and high mountain. And he showed me the great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God. And in the center of the city is the Holy Mount. And the Holy Mount was the Temple Mount, as it were, the place of worship and the Word. So here is Mount Zion, upon which is built, as it were, the temple. And that's where you commune with God. That's where wisdom is itself to be found. And you go up, as it were, to the mount. And there in the very center, if you like, of the city is that sacred place, that holy place, where there is this intercourse with the living and the true God. So even in Eden, there was a mountain. It was the mount of fellowship. It was the mount of communion. It was where God would meet with his people. And there's just that slight hint of a sacred place where God would come and engage in intercourse with Adam and also with Eve, with his son and with his daughter. And then, of course, the other mount is Mount Sinai. On the mount, Moses received the law of God. And there Moses met with God, who was shrouded by the glory cloud. And here is Moses, who was permitted to go up. And he was concealed by the cloud. But it was there that he engaged in communion with God. That's the source of wisdom. It's the source of the law of God. God teaches him from the mount. In Exodus 19 and verse 20, the Lord came down upon Mount Sinai, on the top of the mount, and the Lord called Moses up to the top of the mount, and Moses went up, and the Lord descended, and Moses ascended. God came down, and Moses went up, and Moses went to the law school on the mount and received the law of God. And of course, we cannot overlook the Sermon on the Mount. We are told in Matthew chapter 5, verse 1, that Jesus went up to a mountain. It's almost like the second Moses in a sense. Moses went up to the mount, and he who is the lawgiver, who came down to save us, went up to the mount, and he began to teach. When he was seated, his disciples came to him, and then he opened his mouth. And so the lawgiver expounds the law as he is seated on the mount. This is the wisdom of God. But there is something else which is of interest. If you turn to the book of Isaiah, and Isaiah chapter 2, and reading from verse 1 to verse 4, you will notice that the nations will be going up to the mount in Isaiah chapter 2. The word that Isaiah, the son of Amos, saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem, Isaiah 2, this is, and then verse 2, Now it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established in the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow to it. Many people shall come and say, come and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, and we shall walk in his paths, for out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of God from Jerusalem. He shall judge between the nations and rebuke many people. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. And see, God himself has issued the decree. I have set my son upon my holy hill of Zion. Who is he? He is the one who has made unto us wisdom. That's who he is. He has made unto us wisdom and righteousness, redemption and sanctification. He is the one of whom the apostle says, in him are hid all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. And the day is going to come when the very nations themselves will go up to the mount. Because there upon the mount, which is above all the other mountains, this is imagery. It's just seeking to tell us that this place surpasses all other places, and the nations themselves, they will come from all the world, and they will flow into the house of the Lord, and they will learn the law of the Lord. That's where wisdom is. That's where the law of God is. That's where Christ himself will be, in fact, seated. In paganism, mountains were regarded as the home of the gods, but the mountain of the Lord exalts God above all others. So wisdom itself is is that highest point which bids us rise and aim for the highest. Where is wisdom to be found? She takes her stand on the top of the high hill. Here we meet with God and enter into his counsel in the pursuit of the wisdom that is from above. And the wisdom that is from above is first pure, and then it is peaceable. And that wisdom is like the mountains. It's like the mountains which are everlasting. It's like the everlasting hills. And it's likened to the mountains because the mountains are stable and the mountains are secure. The mountains are a place of refuge and they offer rest. They are majestic and they are magnificent. And here is wisdom, therefore, at the very height, above all other, suggesting to us that what God offers is stable and secure, is a refuge and a place of rest for those that are weary, and they are majestic and magnificent. Therefore, you simple ones, seek wisdom. Love wisdom. Embrace her. Fall in love with her. Marry her. May this be the romance of your life and all the days of your life as you seek to grow in the knowledge of the living and the true God, for his name's sake.